Okay, at this time we begin the checkmen on my mark. I'm K2 Rome, Romeo Hindu Whiskey. I'll eventually figure out my call letter. I'm along with Mel, K2KEY. We are the co-hosts of this little show that tries to answer people's questions about ham radio and electronics, wireless equipment, how to get the best performance out of your ham radio gear, what are the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio like, how the transmission lines work, the latest issue of QST Magazine, the February issue, you're going to be hearing about that. It's got a nice article on the Smith chart, which is one of Mel's very popular set of lectures. A person signs into the TechNet because they've got a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes after that, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So we have a check-in tonight. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. WC2C, yes.
KC2LCY, yes.
Okay, both of those guys didn't give us a name. WC2C, I think, is Aaron. KC2, is it Obo Tango Yankee? Please correct me, sir. And what is your name, sir?
Lima Tango Yankee, Rich.
Very fine, Rich. Lima Tango Yankee. Okay, we got Aaron and Rich. Anyone else?
M-O-C, Mike.
Okay, we got Mike. Anyone else?
Mike Bravo.
I heard N2 Mike Bravo and some guy named Barry. Never heard of him. Who was the other person that doubled with Barry?
KC2, OES, Fred, and yes.
Okay, we got you, Fred. Mel, are you available? Have you checked in yet, Mel?
Oh, yes, I'm right here. Let everybody else check in. Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Fantastic.
WS2N is here. Good evening, Dick.
And Paul is here. All right. We got the whole crew. Got the whole fam family. Very good. All righty. Aaron, Rich, Mike, Fred, Barry. Anyone else with questions or comments, please check in and give me your call letters and name at this time.
N2SLS.
Mark and no.
KC2FDD, Steve and no.
WB2H, Harry, and
Mel.
On the
375,
by the way.
Very fine, Harry. And just as I've heard, the audio is a little bit more mushy up there. Steve, we've got you. All right, the very first person to check in, the number one guy on the runway, ready to take off, is Aaron. WC2C, what would you like to talk about tonight, Aaron? You got the floor. Thank you, Dick. This is WC2C, and Happy New Year to you and other people on the net. The question I have is this. I never learned, and maybe you could tell me, or somebody on the air could tell me, what is inside the white Easy Pass tag that works when you go through the Easy Pass. I mean, what's the whole system about? Does anybody know?
Boy, did you come to the right place, Aaron.
Wow.
Did you come to the right place? You may or may not know that in the year 2000, I retired from Airborne Instruments Laboratory after 35 years of service, and I opened up a consulting business, a radio wireless consulting business. And 5 years ago, I got hired by a company that builds radio frequency identification circuits, RFID. And that is what is inside that tag. It is an RFID device. You're about to ask, what is RFID? I'm pretty sure that EasyPass follows the same UHF rules. By the way, RFID, in other words, little bitty tags that talk back to some kind of a reader or interrogator. You go to your large box store and buy an expensive television, you'll notice that there's a tag on the side of the television, on the outside of the box. And when you pay for the television set, they have to disable that tag in some way, because if you walk out the front door and the reader at the front door says, oh, hold, Aaron's got this box in his hand that he didn't pay for, the alarms go off and they come and talk to you. So some of those work at 13.56 megacycles, particularly the so-called contactless badges that many companies use. That's a kind of an RFID device. Another kind of variation of an RFID device is the metal foil that's on the back of the book that you borrow from the library. As you check out the book, they changed the status of that little metal foil, which says that yes, Aaron did check out this book and he's allowed to walk out with it. If he just picks up the book off the shelf and walks out the front door, the reader at the front door will set off the alarm. But that's a kind of an RFID device, so that's a little bit different. Some of them have very low frequencies at hundreds of KC. Some of them work at 13.5 megs. The longest range ones are the so-called UHF tags at 902 to 928 megacycles, the license free band. And the reader itself, Alan, is a kind of a CW radar. The reader sends out a signal. The signal usually has a, an interrogation request. In other words, it says, all tags where the serial number begins with A, talk to me now. Or all tags, talk to me now. There's some kind of a message that's sent out by the reader. The tag picks up that message, and it says, aha, he's talking to me. The really inexpensive tags that you're going to eventually see on store shelves and clothing stores and whatever has no battery on board. The tag gets enough radio energy from the transmitter. It's usually a 1-watt transmitter with a 6 dB gain antenna, so it's 4 watts of effective radiated power is what you're allowed to use in that nice and free band. And it's a frequency hopping device. It only dwells a few milliseconds on each one of 50 channels between 902 and 928. So it's doing all this work while frequency hopping, so it doesn't jam anybody with their cordless telephone that's also in the same frequency region. So the radio energy sent out by the transmitter is rectified by the tag. The rectified RF energy charges a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery which powers the little chip that's on the tag. The tag is nothing but a dipole at 900 megacycles. And the chip then talks back to you by modulating the voltage that you have given it, the RF voltage you have given it. It changes its reflection coefficient, and it does so at about 100 KC rate. So it's generating sidebands, 100 KC above and below the frequency that you're transmitting. The receiver is looking for those sidebands. Those sidebands go on and off with what you and I would call a very fast
TOS lockup detect.
That would be a very fast Morse code, so to speak, and it sends back a 96-bit message. Some of these tags can be addressable. Some of these tags can be rewritable. You can change the message on the tag. So this is an industry that's going to heavily challenge barcode tags, but it's not going to replace them. They each have their purpose. I've worked on a product, for instance, which is a handheld reader, where you can tell the handheld reader, gee, I've lost box number 45 in this warehouse. You program the handheld reader, find
node number 4478, link clear.
Find me box number 45. You walk up and down the aisles of the warehouse for this box that's got perishable material you haven't seen for 3 months, and pretty soon when you come in within the 20-foot range of the tag, the reader in your hand says, aha, I found it. It's 13 feet off to the right. Go get it. And it's the second box back on the shelf. The nice thing about these RFID tags is you can read the tag on something that you can't see. In the case of a barcode, you have to flash the light-emitting diode across the barcode tag, and it's got to be something you can see.
An error has occurred.
With an
TOS lockup detect.
With an RFID tag, you don't have to see the actual object that you're reading. It could be the second or third shelf box, so to speak. Now, in the case of the EasyPass, it is not a thoroughly passive tag. It is a semi-passive tag. It's got a battery on board. And as such, something like once every 7 years, they've got to give you another one or recharge the battery, change the battery, whatever. The advantage of the battery on board is that now you don't have to send it enough radio energy for it to rectify that energy to charge the capacitor to become the temporary battery. As such,
an error has occurred.
As such,
TOS lockup detect.
As such, you get, as you can tell, some experiments are going on with the very elaborate system that Eric and Andy are hooking up, and they're doing some testing on the system at the same time we're running the net. Now, as I was saying, that the EasyPass tag has a battery on board that gives it a lot more sensitivity, a lot more range, because you don't have to send it enough RF energy for it to rectify that energy to operate the tag. But it still is spitting back something like a 96-bit code that says WC2C has paid his dues for this particular organization, and for the next 3 months he's allowed to go across all these bridges. So these passive reflective devices, there's no real transmitter on board. That's why it's called semi-active in the case of the Easy Pass, because there's a battery on board to run the receiver. The transmitter itself, there is no real transmitter. It is just modulating the impedance on the antenna, changing the reflectivity of the signal that's being sent to that antenna. The receiver or the reader, the interrogator as it's called, looks at the modulation of that variation of reflectivity, and that is the 96-bit code, and there's a cyclic redundancy code, call it a checksum if you like, which verifies that, yes, this is a real tag, this is the serial number, Aaron has paid, he's allowed to go through, we're not going to take his picture when he does it. Very interesting technology. U.S. Visits or the Border Patrol has been experimenting with these things, because in the ultimate situation, they're looking for the day when you will drive through the border at a 40 mile an hour, you'll hold your passport up against the window, the camera will read your license plate, the RFID reader will read the RFID tag that's built into your passport, they'll put the two together and they'll say, yep, that's Aaron's car, I recognize the license plate, that's Aaron's face, I recognize that, that's Aaron's ID code on his passport, he's a good guy, let him go roaring through the border at 40 miles an hour, we're not even going to slow him down. As you can see, it can save a lot of money and time, and the passport that will have this will come in a little holder that when you close the passport and put it in the metallic holder, you will then be shielding the RFID tag so that somebody cannot read the tag that's in your pocket, that's on your passport, when you're not trying to have it intentionally read because you're going through a border. I think you get some of the idea of what kind of industry this is becoming. It's got a huge capability in the future. People have been making all kinds of predictions, Aaron, that how fast it's going to catch on. It's been catching on a little bit more slowly than everyone expected. Walmart 2 years ago predicted that the top 100 vendors would have RFID tags on every item that they ship to Walmart or don't bother shipping them. Well, Linda Dillman made those pronouncements. She was the chief technical officer of this technology at Walmart. She's had to back down a little bit from that initial pronouncement because the hardware was not quite ready in time. This gives you a thumbnail sketch of what it is. You're going to see a lot more of this jazz going on there, Aaron. WC2C, I bet you got more questions. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is all very interesting. It's amazing what these things can do, you know. And I was just wondering how it all works. And it's a good thing they could, you know, differentiate between different people and whatever. Very good, Dick. Well, thank you very much. Certainly very interesting. And next time I go on the New Jersey Turnpike or Verrazano Bridge, whatever, you know, think of all of this as it's happening. Have a good night. Thank you again. This is WC2C.
Yeah, K2KY. One question I was thinking about this, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to pick up Mel's question in a second. There's two or three more pieces of information I should have given you, Aaron. In the case of a barcode, the good news is they're very cheap. They're you know, a fraction of a penny to print onto the label. But you have to see the label. The label's got to be clean. It's got to be within line of sight of a reader. And it gives you something like 15 bits of information, 13 bits of information. The RFID tag can be thoroughly passive and 20 feet away. It can be semi-passive because it's got a battery, and it can be 50 or 100 feet away. It can give you 96 bits of information. It is rewritable. There are variations of the tag which have many more bits than 96 bits. So a whole history of every single port you've gone to in the last 5 years could be written into the tag that's in your passport, if you know what I mean. It could be very handy along those lines. Go ahead with your question, Mel. K2KEY. K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay. Question is, two things. When the tag is read, like an easy tag, what does it go to a central computer system? Because they know when a tag has not been paid for, it's still being used to stop you. So when they're reading it, happens to be on the bridge, you have to go through the tunnel, whatever. What are they doing? Feeding it back instantly to some central computer and then back to the booth stick over?
You've got it exactly right, Mel. There's a large database of all the tag serial numbers that have been paid and the tag serial numbers that are delinquent. They haven't been paid. I presume that that database is either centrally located and computers talk through that centrally located computer real fast through a RF or internet data link, or I think it's possible that each individual bridge and tunnel has their own local copy of the database of the guys who have properly paid and they're allowed to go through. Where the database is contained and how often it's updated is a minor detail, but without a doubt, the reader is connected to a, let's call it a host computer with a database that verifies within a fraction of a second in most cases, I think, that you're the right guy and we don't have to take your picture as you go through because you've paid. When it comes to hardware that you purchase, let's say for instance that Mel and Dick are running a supply chain management organization. In other words, we're the middle guys that run the warehouse between the guy who builds the goods. Mel and I run this warehouse where we temporarily store the goods, and then it gets shipped to a whole lot of individual stores. Well, as the forklift picks up a pallet of goods out of this truck that just arrived at our warehouse, and as the forklift drives through the door, you would like to have the reader, the fixed reader as it's called, located at the door to read every one of the tags on every one of the large boxes of objects that are on that pallet of that forklift as it goes through the door. Therefore, we know which truck delivered which hardware, which door it went through, what day it arrived, and then as the forklift takes that pallet over to a shelf and reads the tag on the shelf, we know what shelf down what aisle that tag was placed, because the forklift has got a reader. The reader on the forklift is talking to a wireless LAN to the computer in the building, and therefore you don't lose your goods. You know what shelf it's on, you know what aisle it's down, and you know when it arrived. And by the same token, when you break up that pallet of goods, and you break it up into smaller things that you're going to ship half of the pallet to store in Maine and another half of the pallet to a store in New Jersey, you know when it left, which door it left through, what truck it went on, when it happened. And so your goods becomes traceable, and once you have track of the goods and you don't end up with losing stuff in the warehouse, the perishable stuff sits on the shelf and goes bad, goes out of date, you waste money. You can see that lots of studies have been taking place to say that if your supply chain management is efficient enough in its database of what stuff flows through where, when, all of a sudden the profit increases, the losses decrease, everybody becomes happy. You do ordering of new goods just in time, so you don't have to store it for long periods of time. Lots of good things can happen from this. I think you get a little bit of the picture there of how you and I could be running this this warehouse, this distribution center, Mel, and we'd be very rich guys, and we'd need a bigger wheelbarrow to take all of our money to the bank. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, K2KEY. The only thing I'm questioning on this is when you, I should say, come in the warehouse with the merchandise, does the code, is the code, in other words, the code that's put on the box, is that an arbitrary, is that, in other words, the company that makes the tag gives you a list of codes, or in other words, the code is pre-printed. Is that correct, that you have a pre-printed code on the tag stick? In other words, they some way supply you what is coming along in the way of code so that you can check it against your inventory or whatever. In other words, what happens there? And also, when it goes through the EasyPass system, what do they have, a shielding between groups, or is it a directed wave of some sort that the adjacent chute where you're going through does not in any way cross over? I mean, what, they have a narrow beam system over?
Okay, Don, good question. First of all, there's at least two different ways to make the tags, Mel. One way is you build the tags with consecutive serial numbers, and the block of serial numbers starting at 10,000 to 12,000 goes to vendor A, and the block of tags from 12,000 to 14,000 goes to That's one approach. The more modern Class 1 Generation 2 tags, as they're called, are rewritable. So therefore, I can write in those 96 bits or more a whole message on the tag that this is the Schneider Natal Company, and they build these great radios. And so we assign our own serial numbers with our own logo, so to speak, or with our own brand name onto the tags. We burn that into the tag, and so that when the reader at the warehouse or at the final store for selling the radios reads the tag, they know either because of the block of serial numbers or because of the identification that we have written into the tag, and many of the tags are now rewritable, we can get our message across. It's as good as having printing on the outside of the box, so to speak, as the brand name, date of manufacture, when it was shipped. Picture the situation when you've got 20,000 shipping containers entering the United States per day. Lots of stuff comes shipped into our ports, places like New York City and San Francisco and Los Angeles and whatever. And so if each one of these major boxes inside of those shipping containers have tags on them, and if the tags are rewritable, in theory, you can rewrite information into the tag on each one of the ports the tag goes to. Let's assume that good started off in Singapore, and it goes to India, and then it goes to some place in Africa, and then it ends in New York City. And you'd like to know what days, what hours it was in what port, how long it was there, and so on. And there's various ways of protecting the tag so that people are not scrambling it, so that it's only being read by authorized people at the right time. And so traceability of goods is something that the military is very interested in. Vendors like Walmart and Target and other major companies are very interested in tracking goods, not losing the goods, making sure that theft doesn't take place. I mean, if you have a reader on every single truck, and therefore you know when the material entered the truck, when it left the truck, what hour it left the truck, and so on, all of a sudden a hell of a lot of theft disappears. There are certain kinds of goods, say for instance cigarettes, which is amazing to me, a huge percentage of the cigarettes that are sold in the United States.
Node number 4478, link active.
A huge percentage of the cigarettes sold in the United States are not by the original manufacturer, or they didn't go through the original intended supply chain. There are people who, in some cases, steal the cigarettes when they leave the factory, before they arrive at the warehouse, before I think the tariffs and the taxes are paid. In other words, they suck the stuff out of the beginning of the supply chain, resupply it back into the tail end of the supply chain, and the United States government is losing a whole lot of taxes. That's just one of a number of crazy situations that take place because of a lack of traceability of the goods. The supply chain management is not properly authorized and authenticated and so on. RFID tags have the ability to do that. Now, when it comes to the antennas that are used for the readers, the majority of the antennas that are in fixed readers that are against the wall, flat panel antennas, are a circular polarized antenna with 9 dB of gain, which has got around 70 degrees of beam width. So depending on where you aim the antenna, it's got a directed beam that will only read things that are in front, and it's got a reasonable rejection ratio, front-to-back ratio. Also, if you've got readers on each one of the multiple ports, or each one of the multiple lines you go through at a border, which line gets the strongest response, because you've got a central computer coordinating all of this now, you can easily figure out which one of the aisles you went through. Now, when you and I go through a border, on the assumption that everything is hunky-dory, we've got the right passport, the right automobile, and so on, whether you went through aisle number one or aisle number three doesn't matter so much. Where it does matter is when stuff is coming from a warehouse and about to be loaded onto a truck, and one of the biggest problems is the forklift operator made a mistake and he put your beautiful, valuable goods on the wrong truck, the truck that's going to Maine as opposed to the truck that's going to New Jersey. And so which port, which portal, which shipping dock did the equipment go through is very important, and therefore some fancy techniques are being used to find out, is the material going through the portal from north to south or south to north? In other words, is it entering the building? Is it leaving the building? and which portal, which dock door did it go through, which truck did it go on, and there's all kinds of checks and balances required to do that. Some of it's done with signal strength, some of it's done with direction finding and velocity measurements, some of it's done with antenna directivity. If you're smart enough in designing the system, you get it right 99.9% of the time. Now back to you for some further questions on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, it's okay, very good. I'm just going to give some final words on it. I understand that the Department of Light is considering now the automotive up in Albany, the Department of Light for automotive. They are considering now, how did they put it, to some way encode into your registration some kind of a system that both your registration and your inspection sticker to notify a police car. In other words, they're going to add something, I guess, to the equipment of the police car, that the police car rides by your car's box or whatever, or passes it on the road, it'll immediately say that that car is, if it's the license, that the inspection is in, date. If it's all, like you say, legitimate. Is that really possible to do that out on an open area like a street? Do you think this is already pushing it too far, Dick? Over.
Oh, is it pushing it too far? Not only is it dreamed about, not only has it been on the drawing board, it is deployed and being used in the city of Hoboken, New Jersey. Hoboken, New Jersey has 15,000...
And New York, but
15,000 people in Hoboken, in that town, all want to park in that town. And I think there's only a couple thousand parking spots for those 15,000 people. What the city of Hoboken did was to issue RFID tags that you glue to the window of the car. The patrolman, the traffic policeman, I'm going to call them, in the town, walk up and down the street with a handheld device that I had something to do with the design of. I designed the antenna that sits on the front end of the thing. And they literally flash it at your window, and they can do it from 10 feet away of your car, read the tag and say, aha, Mel is one of the government workers in Hoboken. He's allowed to park his car on the street between these hours and those hours, and that's a valid car, and I don't have to give him a ticket. So your traffic control people walk up and down the street in Hoboken, reading the tags on the cars, and they've been doing that now for at least 6 months, to my knowledge, maybe a year. And I had something to do with that. The person who just mentioned New York City, give me a couple of words on that. Start off with your call letters and your name, and where in New York City is it being used? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
It's Rich, K2LDY. I heard on the news several months ago where they're using this in a police car. They just pointed out their window on the passing car and get all the information from the vehicle and owner, etc. It's at least a year now from what I heard.
Question? Now, Rich, in that particular case, where is the tag mounted? Is it mounted on the license plate, or is it something that's issued to each driver and he sticks it to the windshield of his car? Give us a few more words on that one, Rich.
It's off your registration sticker on the windshield.
Okay, so the registration sticker is what I think you're saying contains an RFID tag. Person with the question, start over here, call it as a name, and proceed with your question, sir.
Good evening, Dick. It's Taj, N2KDN. My question, I heard the discussion, I've been jumping in and out because I was at work, but with the RFID tag, I was wondering if what they call the FOBs work on the same principle. We were just issued ours in our fire department, so when we come to sign in for calls to keep track of our percentages and stuff, we just wave it across the reader and it beeps and we're on our way. I imagine it's the same RFID principle.
I'm just hearing about those this very week, Taj, and as I find more about it, I'll be telling you next week. I just heard those words this time a couple days ago, where in some cases those fobs that a fireman or an EMS person carries gives them access to certain areas, open locks, allows him to officially sign in to work as to what hour he arrived, when he left, what vehicle he climbed into. And to my knowledge, those are also RFID tags. People call them fobs, but to my knowledge, you don't actually plug them in. If it was a fob or one of these, flash RAM type things where you ship a whole lot of data by the sneaker net, as they call it. In other words, you plug in a USB port on your desktop computer and dump data into this little thing and walk away with it and dump the data into another computer. Now, that's a real electronic connection. The thing you're talking about is a wireless connection, to my knowledge. Therefore, most likely, it is also an RFID device. If it is an RFID device that can only be read a fraction of a foot, most likely it's running at 13.56 megs. The longest range tags used in both Europe, United States, Asia, and so on, are the ones running on the 900 megacycle or 868 megacycle band in Europe and 902 megacycle band shared with ham radio in the United States. Those are the ones that have the capability of going out to a range of 20 feet. To read a thoroughly passive tag from 20 feet away where there is no battery on board and the thing talks back to you, and it talks back to you on exactly the right frequency because it is using your signal to send back its signal. It doesn't even have a transmitter on board. Very crafty. So, to my knowledge, these are wireless. Most likely, these are RFID tags. Back to you, Cash, if you want to give us any further information. N2KDN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
What about laser called
QGZ?
QGZ, Bill recognized. When it comes to laser code, what you really mean, a laser reader, barcode readers, the bad thing about barcode readers is it's got to be optically observable, it's got to be clean, and you only get something like 13 or 15 bits of data, unless you're using the two-dimensional barcode or the three-dimensional barcode. And they've got their pluses and minuses. I think for the service you're talking about, less likely to be a barcode laser red-like thing, light-emitting diode red. I think RFID of either the near field or the far field type, 13.56 meg, which is an inductively read tag. That's one type, or the long range ones at 900 meg. Bill, I bet you've been running into these things, and I bet you've got something to contribute. Have you beat your QGZ? KQLIW. You got it, Bill.
Take it easy, a couple things quick. The key fob style device and the regular flat photo ID with the impregnated device in it for opening doors are the same. In my firehouse here, the readers in the firehouse respond to my work ID, which is the flat card, and same thing at work. It responds to it, it tries to read it, it rejects it as the incorrect number, but it does decode it and display it. It just says you're not allowed to be in here with that particular ID. For some reason, I thought some of that documentation I saw for that system, I want to say it's made by a company called HID or something, I thought they ran closer to approximately a megahertz or so, but I could be mistaken. I looked at it very quickly. That was what I recall. The other thing about the registration information in New York, I think there is a barcode on the... on your registration sticker, and you can get that scanned, for example, when you go to get inspected, then it'll drag your information up. You have to be close enough to get in and scan that with a conventional barcode reader, though. You can't do it from any significant distance. I know the police department at Nassau and Suffolk, and probably in New York City, have been doing, is an optical character recognition of your plate. It uses an infrared illuminator and a camera, and it's able to kind of lock to your plate, read your plate, and then if you have any sort of outstanding stuff, it'll point it out in an automated fashion. So the operator of the car just drives along, and something beeps at him and says, hey, there's a plate over here that's, expired, stolen, whatever. But I don't believe there's any way to interrogate a registration or a registration sticker for information like that. Okay?
That's what I was talking about.
Very fine. Bill, when it comes to the contactless badges, what they used to be called, these things where you don't have to make contact to them and it can read it. There are some of them that run at roughly 100 kc, some of them run at roughly 1 megacycle, some run at 13.56 megacycles, some of them at 400 meg, some of them at 900 meg, some of them at 2 gig, some of them at 5 gig. So there's a whole bunch of frequency regions depending on the technique. All the ones, to my knowledge, below 900 meg are inductive readers. In other words, Yes, it is RF, 13 meg, 1 meg, 100 kc, and so on, but there is a coil of wire in the tag, which is read by the near field magnetic field created by the reader, and they work over a foot or less distance. Some of them have to be only inches away, but they do the job very effectively. They can transmit quite a bit of data, a lot more data than you would get with a barcode, with normal barcodes, until you go into the two-dimensional barcodes. And yes, pattern recognition type optical readers are now becoming quite prevalent. There's a whole class of barcode readers that do not scan by moving a mirror back and forth, a light-emitting diode. They literally are a kind of a floodlight that lights up the whole tag, and there's the equivalent of a camera with a very fancy pattern recognition program in the camera that reads the barcode. Pluses and minuses in each of these things to range, readability, accuracy, how much light is required, how much background light it can tolerate, and so on. Each has its advantages and disadvantages. But when it comes to authorization, recognition of things that people carry, badges and things like this, allowing to go in certain areas, allow them to climb into certain vehicles, allow them to use certain weapons. As you can see, this is just the beginning of a vast industry that a lot of people are predicting is going to be tens and hundreds of billions of dollars worth of business sometime in the near future. It's had a couple of false starts, but it's moving along very nicely. There are something like 100 companies in the United States that are pursuing this business, whether it is manufacturing the tags, manufacturing the readers, or integrating systems with computers that tie it all together. There's probably an equal number of companies in Europe and Africa and Asia doing this kind of work. The European system is quite different than the United States in that the long-range tags, UHF tags, theirs are on something like 868 megacycles, ours are on 902 megacycles. We're allowed 4 watts of transmission, they're only allowed 2 watts. We've got 50 channels, they've only got 4 channels. So they're going to have a real traffic problem as we see it. Unless their agency that controls it is called FDETSI, unless FDETSI modifies their rules and relaxes them quite a bit, the restriction of power output and the restriction of the number of channels is going to create quite a traffic jam over there, is what many smart people in the United States are predicting. And their rules are going to more and more start turning into the rules of the United States, is the prediction of some of the smart people. Hey, Aaron, look what you created by this question. WC2C, why did you get us rolling? C2RAW in the tech net. Did Aaron go away already after asking that beautiful question? Looks like he didn't. Couldn't hang around for all that information. Okay, Rich was the next person. KC2LTY. Rich, what would you like to talk about tonight? KC2RAW and Mel. My name is Nick. His name is Mel. Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, my question involves the HF tuner. I acquired a model MFJ versus tuner 2, model MFJ 941 tuner a few years back to swap and shop. And I could not get the tuner to operate properly. I disassembled the unit and found that 12 position rotary switch, about 20-25% of the terminals were burnt off from the switch. So there was damage done. I don't know what caused it. Long story short, I got a replacement switch from MFJ, identical, installed it into the unit, and I can use the unit to adjust my SWR on HF 10 meters, for instance, to a flat SWR using an external meter, but the tuner has a built-in meter and it does not match my external meter. It goes berserk. What am I doing wrong?
Hey, you may not be doing anything wrong, Rich. First of all, a smart person using a tuner will use it in his transmitter's tune mode, something like 10 watts of output, while he's adjusting the controls on the tuner. Particularly the kind of tuners that have a rotary switch, where you're making one set of, you're breaking one set of contacts and making another set of contacts. You do that at the kilowatt level, and you'll burn up any tuner that's got a rotary switch to it, because those poor contacts are going to be arcing, and it's just a matter of time before they fail. So tuning should be done at a low power. Obvious by the amount of damage you saw and the repair you had to do, which the person who owned it before you abused the living daylights out of it. But you being a smart guy who knows how to troubleshoot electronics and knows how to fix things, you've got the tuner portion working. Now, the internal meter really is a poor man's equivalent of a bird watt meter. It must have directivity. In other words, most meters that are built into tuners have a mode by which you can read forward power and reverse power, or they look at the forward and reverse power simultaneously and apply them to a chunk of logic that calculates the standing wave ratio for you. But in one way or another, you have to either minimize the reflected power back to your transmitter, that's what happens when the tuner is working correctly, or minimize the standing wave ratio that the transmitter sees. There's a very strong similarity between those two. And in order for that to happen, the power sensor for forward and reverse built into the tuner must have its directivity. In order for it to have directivity, it's got to have the proper terminating resistor built inside, the right coupling capacitor, the right coupling loop, a good set of diodes in there that look at forward power and reverse power. In the process of the previous owner abusing the living daylight out of your MFJ941 tuner, not only did he burn up that rotary switch, the multi-contact switch, that's probably adjusting the tap points on the coils, he probably damaged the circuitry of the directional coupler, the thing that looks at forward and reverse power. By studying it, by finding where it is in the inside, with your own meter, you can check that the resistor there hasn't been burned up, that the diodes are good, that the coupling loop doesn't have a char on it, and so on. Once you study the right section of the ARRL antenna book, and there's probably a similar section in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, on standing wave ratio bridge devices, or directional watt meters. So really the exact same device, by the way. Whether you're using a bird watt meter to measure forward and reverse power, whether you're using a brand A or a brand B standing wave ratio bridge, you're really using the exact same circuitry. The only thing different is the way it's calibrated, and whether it's the dial reads forward and reverse power in watts, whether it reads forward and reverse power in volts, or forward and reverse power in standing wave ratio, whether it's got one needle or two needles, they're all the same circuitry. It's a directional watt meter. So in the process of him abusing, my guess is he has also damaged that section. And I'm pretty sure, Rich, you're a smart enough guy, now that you know what you're looking for, you will, in a short period of time, make that work. And even if you don't, and even if you have trouble doing that, eventually you go over to Andy's at A2CDL, and he'll help you make it work. So one way or the other, Rich, in the next week or two, that portion of your MFJ is going to be working too. You've got something to look forward to. KC2LTY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Activity timeout.
Node number 4478, link clear.
Okay, so using my external cross-needle meter, is doing it safely so I don't damage my radio. Okay, yeah, I know, Andy. Yes, a while back I was struck by lightning during the summer and lost a 2 meter radio in a house. Okay, so I'm doing it right. Forget about the needle. The meter in the tuner. In my external meter, it's working okay for me. Okay, yeah, my question.
This is DPZ with a comment. DPZ, you're right ahead.
Yeah, on that meter, if you go straight through on your tuner into a terminated 50-ohm load, and the watt meter in the tuner is reading crazy, 9 times out of 10, you have two diodes on there. They're germanium diodes. They're shot. Replace those two diodes, the other ramifications just come right up to life. It's a common problem on that model tuner.
Okay, thank you for the information. And it was probably Andy that also was making a comment there, but they're experimenting with the linking system, and so as they iron the bugs out of it, he'll eventually be able to talk to us simultaneously. I think you can make it work I wouldn't give up on this one, Rich. Out of curiosity, your external meter, are you using it between your transmitter and the tuner, or are you using it after the tuner to the antenna? My guess is you're using it in the first location. Is that true, Rich?
The meter is between the transmitter and the tuner.
That's the right way to do it. And I'm assuming that your assumption that your dual needle standing wave ratio meter is running correctly. When you adjust the tuner control so that you see minimum reflected power or best standing wave ratio on your meter between the exciter and the tuner, that's the right way to do it. And so you're up and flying as I see it. But you'll eventually make that that directional coupler that inside of your MHA work correctly if you want to, and I think you should. And that way you'll have it up to tip-top condition. And as you do decide to do that later on, please come back and let us know how the repair went and whether or not Mr. TPZ was right on what you needed to do the repair. Okay, I think Mike was the next person who signed in, N2MOC, if I got your call list correct, Mike. Go right ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
One question.
N2MOC. I didn't have a question initially, but with the antenna tuner question, I do have one that I'd like to ask. When you use the antenna tuner with a random wire, which I'm using on HF, and I'm able to tune up the antenna, what is the efficiency at that point? Can you make a comment on what I'm actually getting with respect to the efficiency of a random wire antenna with the antenna tuner?
Certainly,
I've got a Kenwood 850 with the internal antenna tuner.
Very quick. We're going to give you an answer on that in a second. Was it you, Rich, that had an additional question?
Yeah, it's a little odd that I acquired the tuner through the swapping shop few years back. That's just my comment. All right, I appreciate all the info. Okay, love you, Rich.
Yeah, let us know what you find out, Rich, as you dig in deeper, and I think you eventually will. And you probably got it at a medium good price because it had been damaged. And for a guy like you that's crafty enough, 90% of the right electronics is already there. And so making it work the way you want to is...
Node number 4478, link active.
So for you to make it work the heck, you know, it's kind of fun to make all your electronics work at maximum efficiency. And you're eventually going to want to do that, as I see it, Rich. Now, when it comes to Mike's question, Mike, we've got good news for you. When your transmitter creates RF energy, let's assume you've got a typical 80 to 10 meter rig that puts out 100 watts. Of that 100 watts, you would like 99 of those watts or more to get to the antenna. And you're going to be going through a transmission line, an antenna tuner, and eventually to the antenna. And so all of those components can only do three things. Number one, they pass the energy through the transmission line, through the antenna tuner, onto the antenna, and it gets radiated into space. That's item number one. That's the most desirable thing. Number two, if the transmission line is not properly terminated, if the antenna tuner is not doing its job, the transmitter sees some standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio is a fancy way of saying that a certain percentage of your power is being reflected back down the transmission line toward the antenna. That's number two. And number three, if the devices you're using, the transmission line happens to be the wrong kind, too small in diameter, got water in it, or the antenna tuner is not properly designed, in either case, they can burn up some of your RF power by turning it into heat. So there's only three things that can happen to your RF. Radiate into space, reflect it back to the transmitter, or turn into heat. You have the ability to find out how much of each one of those is happening. I'll admit how much is radiated into space by measuring volts per meter and field strength out in front of the antenna. I'm going to admit that is hard. You don't have to do that one. If you can satisfy the other two things and you recognize the fact that there's only three things that can happen to your RF. Item number two is reflected back to the transmitter. You can detect that real fast with your standing wave ratio meter, or you can borrow one from somebody and put it between the transmitter and the tuner. And if the standing wave ratio is low, then you know that the power is going forward because none of it's coming back. Number three, when it comes to things burning it up with heat, the three things you can do there to find out. Number one, you can look at the status of your transmission line. Is it super thin stuff that's going to have a lot of loss, or is it the larger diameter cable that you know is low in loss, does it have water in it? You can put power into one end and measure how much comes out of the other end and find out what is the insertion loss of your cable. That's number one. That's one of the things that can go wrong with the cable. When it comes to the antenna tuner being inefficient, the only way an antenna tuner can be inefficient is it burns up the power into heat. You transmit 100 watts to your antenna tuner, key down for 10 minutes, lift up the key and walk over there real fast and touch everything, maybe even open up the case and touch everything. Whether or not you feel any heat with your hand is something that's very sensitive. If you're putting 100 watts through an antenna tuner, and if one of the components inside is not working correctly, and it's dissipating 1 watt of your 100 watts, 1 watt for 10 minutes is a significant amount of heat. Your hand will feel that immediately. It's a very sensitive test. Of course, you turn off the transmitter before doing that. So by way of touching things, you'll find out, is anything getting hot? If it's running cold, and if it doesn't have a really terrible shielding, and if the case is not doing the radiating, and if it's not reflecting the power, you've got it made. The bottom line of all this, Mike, is that 98% of the time, a reasonable brand name of antenna tuner, properly being used into a reasonable antenna, and your long wire antenna, believe it or not, is a reasonable antenna. I'll admit, if you mount it flat against the lawn as a Herbie Snake antenna, and it's in direct contact with the ground, the antenna itself is going to be low in efficiency. You're going to be heating up the dirt quite a bit as a dummy load and keeping the worms warm and making them happy in the wintertime. But that's not an inefficiency of the tuner, that's an inefficiency of the antenna. So,
COS, lockup detect.
So by way of these detection techniques, you will know if you want to. But as I said, a high percentage of the time, antenna tuners working correctly are extremely high efficiency. It's hard to design one that's bad that wouldn't burn up when you put 100 watts through it because of the heat that it generates. There are lots and lots of guys out there that you get on 20 meters on Saturday afternoons, you discuss this subject with a mic, a certain percentage, a significant percentage of the data you're going to get is terrible. There's a significant number of guys out there who say, gee, my antenna has a high standing wave ratio, it's reflecting power.
Node number 4478.
They make clear. They make the assumption that the antenna tuner simply eats up the reflected power. Absolutely, positively not. It does not eat up the reflected power. When your antenna tuner is working correctly, it takes all that reflected power from the antenna, re-reflects it forward in such a way that it's doing it efficiently, and the re-reflected forward power is in phase with the power that is coming out of your transmitter at this time and adds to it. A properly adjusted antenna tuner does all that magic for you. And what you call...
an error has occurred.
What you call...
COS lockup detect.
What you call antenna tuner really is a larger range final tank tuning circuit. The Heathkit HW100 or any of the other rigs we used to have in the old days, which had a large tuning and loading capacitor and a large tuning range, you could say the antenna tuner was built into those rigs. Along comes a modern-day amateur radio operator who wants his rig to be solid-state, no-tune, and compact. The manufacturers have done that for you, but they say, gee,
An error has occurred.
They keep telling you...
COS lockup detect.
They keep telling you that the antenna connected to the rig, this no-tune rig, has to be under a 1.5 standing wave ratio. So we've taken away the tuning range we used to have, and now we put it externally, or as a separate package, in the so-called antenna tuner. The antenna tuner is not any different than the large tuning range tank circuit you used to have in the old-fashioned tube transmitters. They ran efficient. A well-designed antenna tuner also runs efficient. Back to you, Mike. M2MOC, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, K2LIW,
and the TechNet.
All right, thank you for that. That's comforting to know. So as long as with the Kenwood with their internal antenna tuner, I'm looking at my SWR, and I'm under 1.5 as I'm transmitting, and so that means that it's getting out. All right, that's fine. Thank you. That's good. I'll let you take the next question. You got, I guess, 4 more minutes on the net, so let somebody else get the question.
Yeah, we got a lot more than 4 minutes, Mike. This TechNet used to be 1 hour long in the very beginning in 1982. Now, this is TechNet number 1170. 25 and a quarter years later, quite often Mel and I get enough questions and enough things to discuss that we go on until midnight if the Limon people are willing to leave the repeater open that long. So there are times we go for 4 hours when there's enough questions and enough enthusiasm. Okay, the next guy was Fred, KC2OES. Back to you, Fred. And I believe you mailed me some nice pictures this week. KC2OES, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, Mel, and all on the net. Last week I talked about my project, the five element J-beam built around basically a J-pole. I finished the antenna, some of the results that I've gotten. Also, I sent you photos while we're chatting of the finished antenna. We have results of approximately 1.4 in the middle of the band, which is 146 megahertz, 1.6 on the low end, 1.6 on the high end. I get approximately 3 S units of rejection, and my question in relation to this project is that good or bad, and how can I improve it?
Okay, the numbers you gave me, you didn't say what they are, but I'm going to assume they are standing wave ratio numbers. And the rejection you're talking about, you didn't say what it was, but I'm guessing it is front-to-back ratio of the beam. And the 3S units of improvement, I guess you're saying, is the gain that you're seeing. And you have to worry about the fact that the most standing wave ratio, and most S-meters and most receivers are very poorly calibrated. In fact, when you guys get the February issue of QSC Magazine, there's a circuitry in there which tries to give you a lot more linearity and proper calibration. And it's got all the definitions in there of what a signal strength meter, an S-meter, on a well-calibrated receiver is supposed to be. The original intent of an S-meter is that S9 was going to be 50 microvolts. S8 is going to be half of that, 25 microvolts. S7 is going to be half of that, 12.5 microvolts, and so on. So going down from S9 to S1, going up from S9 to a plus 50 or 60 dB over, all defined in that article. And there's a circuitry in there which has got a beautiful logarithmic amplifier that linearizes your nonlinear receiver. I haven't read enough of the article yet to really figure out exactly how they're using it. It looks like they're connecting it to the audio system. I'm not sure you can get enough dynamic range out of that. So although the circuitry does what it's supposed to do, will you be able to marry it to the receiver to do it correctly and get all the dynamic range you want? I've got some questions on that. Now, in the case of your J-beam, which is a J-fed-driven element, Yagi-like antenna, and you've got these sliding plastic PVC pieces of pipe on the various elements, which allows you to adjust the coupling coefficient and tuning of the element. But what you're about to find out, as I see it, Fred, is that a Yagi antenna is not one single design. You've chosen five elements, a certain length of boom, a certain spacing between the elements, and now you can electronically adjust the length of the elements. And there's no one Yagi design. There's an infinite number of Yagi designs. And when you try to measure a Yagi for best standing wave ratio, best front-to-back ratio, best forward gain, you're into an extremely difficult testing procedure. In the case of testing an amplifier, a transmitter, or a receiver, you can do bench testing. In other words, you've got shielded coaxial cables, you've got a shielded signal generator, you connect the signal generator to the receiver, you pour in various signals, and you find out what's going to happen. Very controlled environment. When you're testing an antenna, you're no longer just testing the antenna, you're simultesting the environment you put the antenna in. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd be an astronaut out in space, in free space, and there'd be no reflecting objects nearby while you test your antenna. Or you'd be testing it in the middle of a beautiful anechoic chamber where all the signals coming out of the antenna hit the walls, get absorbed, nothing gets reflected, and you don't have any ambiguity of the measurement. Now let's be realistic. In my backyard, I have set up antenna ranges, and I've won antenna competitions on 5 or 6 years doing that. So if you're smart enough, you can take a reflective environment and control the reflection. Use the reflections in your favor. A ratiometry antenna range, which is described in the February 1976 issue of QSC Magazine, an oldie, way back in the dark ages. That's one approach, which, by the way, has been picked up by the Air Force, and they're now using it at the Rome Air Development Center. And I'll be picking it up from that particular article, or did they reinvent it on their own? I don't know. It doesn't matter. But as you can tell, there are various ways of setting up an antenna range. So assuming